right, beloved, my goal tonight, I don't know if we can pull this off or not, is to finish the book of Jeremiah. Can it be done? I don't know. All right, let's take our Bibles and turn to the 50th chapter, if you will. Chapter 50 of the book of Jeremiah. We're looking at chapters 50 and 51. And we mentioned last week, let me just rehearse some of the things that I tried to spend a little time on. Jeremiah is evidence in several places, but especially here, of the concept of the antinomy. The antinomy is something for which there is no law to explain the phenomenon. And of course, the issue in these two chapters is, how can God actually foreordain and predestinate Babylon to be his, as Isaiah put it, his iron, his hammer, and yet then punish them for doing so. That's part of what makes God God. His ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are beyond our thoughts. And sometimes it's just unproductive to try to come up with a rational explanation for how he conducts himself. And then that's even doubly true for issues of salvation. How can we be said to be saved, known, elect before the foundations of the earth, and yet only in time, when we actually exercise our responsibility to believe, are we actually justified by grace through faith? Both of those things are true. You can't have one without the other, and that's just the way it is. Okay, so we're looking then at the end, Babylon, the destruction of Babylon, God's vengeance on Babylon. I mean, those words are even an antinomy of some degree. Now, the section it divides into three different sections. The first 28 verses of chapter 50, you have God declaring war on Babylon, right? 28 verses of basically what amounts to a war declaration, and it divides neatly into six different movements within the 28 verses. Let me just rehearse them quickly. God speaks to the Jews and about the Jews in verses 4 through 10. Okay, he's speaking to the Jews and about the Jews. But then, beginning in verse 11, 12, and 13, he's now talking to Babylon, telling them what he's going to do to them. And then in verses 14 through 16, I'm in chapter 50 now, he's speaking to the invading armies. He's talking to the host of Cyrus, and by extension, the armies of Alexander the Great. All right, and then in verses 17 through 20, he's speaking again about the Jews. All right, so God's doing all the talking here until the very end. In the fifth movement, he is speaking to the invaders once again, in verses 21 through 27. And then finally, the Jewish remnant speaks up, and they have a thing to say in verse 28. And that ends the first section on God's declaration of war on Babylon. All right, that brings us now, we left off there last week, I believe we did, and we want to look now at the second section. It begins in verse 29 of chapter 50, and it goes clear through to verse 26 of chapter 51. So you got this is the biggest section of all of the three sections. All right, so what's happening here is God is essentially gathering the armies against Babylon. Right? He's calling in his war machine to attack these people. Now remember, the very first command that's given in this section was in verse 2 of chapter 50. All right? Notice there, declare ye among the nations. Okay? Now, the command in verse 29 is, all you guys with bows and arrows, get ready to go. All right, and you can see that very clearly in verse 29 of chapter 50. Call together the archers against Babylon. All ye that bend the bow, camp against it round about. Let none thereof escape. recompense her according to her work, according to all that she hath done, do unto her, for she hath been proud against the Lord, against the Holy One of Israel." So you have here a very definitive indication that God is a God of comeuppance, but only in a righteous way. He doesn't do it like we do it. He believes in the laws of sowing and reaping. He actually created the world which set those things in motion, and he will absolutely prevail. So what God's doing here is he's ordering the armies of the Medes and the Persians, right? Because it's going to be the Medes and the Persians that are going to be the first ones to do Babylon in. And then later on, Alexander the Great will perform the coup de grace, I think is what you call it. And God says, shoot to kill and let no one get away. Really, it's things that kind of shock you that God would say these things, but that is what he's saying. All right, so again, you have a series of speeches here. It's actually all one speech that has five movements in it. Okay, so let's go through the movements in this second section now. Now, what's the second section? God is calling the armies of the world, particularly the Medes and Persians under Cyrus, and later on Alexander the Great, to perform his bidding. All right, in the first place, beginning in verse 31 of chapter 50, going down to verse 4 of chapter 51, God is again addressing Babylon. And you'll notice that he tells them he's against them because of what? If you had to guess, what would God be against them about? What's the first and number one thing that God hates, whether you're Babylonian or Chinese or whatever? Yeah, okay, but there's something even behind that. Pride. Absolute pride. Absolutely. And that's the thing that God hates the most, and that's what he's nailing them for. Notice in verse 31, "Behold, I am against thee, O thou," what? "Most proud, saith the Lord God of hosts, for thy day is come, the time that I will visit thee, and the most proud," all this is, he's addressing Babylon, "the most proud shall stumble and fall, and none shall raise him up. And I will kindle a fire in his cities, and it shall devour all round about him." So God's against them for their pride, verses 31 and 32. And he's going to get retribution for the way that they mercilessly went way above and beyond what they had been commissioned to do, and caused the Jews to suffer needlessly, senselessly, in mind-boggling ways that were completely unnecessary in verse 33. Right? Notice, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the children of Israel and the children of Judah were oppressed together, and all that took them captives held them fast. They refused to let them go." The implication there is that they just poured it on. There were times that they could have shown some kind of mercy, but they absolutely showed zero. The exiles were powerless to free themselves, but their strong Redeemer was going to, he would ultimately free them. You see a phrase, "plead their cause," in verse 34, all right, and that is actually said of the pre-incarnate Christ in verse 34. Their Redeemer, who's that? It's the Lord Jesus. Right, is strong. The Lord of hosts is his name. He shall thoroughly plead their cause. Why? That he may give rest to the land and disquiet the inhabitants of Babylon. So God would eventually come to, it's kind of like the tribulation. There would be no one surviving if God did not cut that time short. Well, you have the same kind of phenomenon here with this particular scenario in time and in history. So that phrase, plead their cause, it's like God is setting up a court case, all right? And only it's a very unusual court case, because Jehovah is the defense attorney. He also is the judge, and he is also the jury. And his verdict is guilty as charged against Babylon. Now, the Lord tells Babylon what to expect when the boom finally gets lowered on the day of their judgment. And he paints a series of pictures about this. All right, the first picture is that of a sword. Now, kind of use your imagination. There's this big sword, and it's like a missile, and it's just moving through the land, and it's cutting down people, right? And that's the picture in verses 35 through 37. Notice, a sword is upon the Chaldeans. Who are the Chaldeans? It's another name for the Babylonians, right? And upon the inhabitants of Babylon, upon their princes, upon her wise men. A sword is upon the liars, and they shall dote. A sword is upon her mighty men, and they shall be dismayed. A sword is upon their horses. And you can see, and so on and so on. So the emphasis is on this metaphorical sword that is going to attack even the waters and dry them up, according to verse 38. It conjures back up the picture of Moses extending his rod into the waters of the Nile River and turning them into blood, you know, having this supernatural phenomenon take place. And not only that, why is God going to do this? Because according to verse 38, it is completely a land filled with satanic idols. You can see that in 38, a drought is upon her waters, and they shall be dried up, for it is the land of graven images, and they are mad upon their idols. They're insane. They're insane with idolatry. And I guess idolatry gives itself to that. It just makes you basically nuts. You're just become a madman in your idolatry. If you don't believe it, watch these young people at these concerts going berserk. Now, half of them are on drugs, but I think you can see at least some kind of illustration of that. So it's going to be kind of like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, okay? Very much like that, to the extent that there will not be anything left. Nothing left. See verse 40. As God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah and the neighbor cities thereof, saith the Lord, so shall no man abide there, neither shall any son of man dwell therein. Instead, Babylon, what used to be this amazing metropolis, this wonder of the world with their hanging gardens and just a sight, a feast for the eyes, no matter where you were from, if you had the opportunity to behold it, they're going to become a haven for nasty animals, carnivorous birds, and the city is just going to be an ash heap. It'll be uninhabitable. All right, so what happens is the Lord directs Babylonians' attention to the great army that he is calling out of the north, and he does that on purpose. They came out of the north to torture and terrorize the Jews, and the people that he's going to use now are also going to come out of the north. They came where, remember when the old Kurds, Saddam Hussein was, he was torturing the Kurds. That's where ancient Persia was, the Medes and the Persians. In fact, many of them are the ancestors of these very people, the Kurds. But they're fierce, and they know how to fight, and they come out of the north, and they show up without mercy, the same way that Babylon showed up. And God describes the marching of the hoofbeats of the camels and their animals and their own feet as the roaring of a sea, the tempestuous sound of an ocean that's being stirred up in verse 42. See, they shall hold the bow and the lance. They are cruel. They will not show mercy. Their voice shall roar like the sea, which can be pretty intimidating. So when the king of Babylon hears this, who at this time is Belshazzar, he becomes paralyzed, because just like a hungry lion looking for prey in a starved condition, Cyrus comes marching in, the Medes and the Persians. And then even more, I think verse 42 points actually telescopes even further into Alexander. for reasons that I'll share with you in just a minute. It is actually more accurately a picture of what Alexander did to these people than what Cyrus actually did to them. And so nobody's going to be able to escape. There'll be no significant resistance that'll be able to be put up, because God's chosen servant will always succeed, always, without exception, no matter who the servant is. It's guaranteed success. So the Lord's judgment on Babylon is going to be like it's going to be like the winnowing of grain, right? Can you picture that in your mind? First the grain is cut down in the field. It's tamped down then it dries out, and then you take the pitchfork and you blow it up so that the chaff separates and all that. It's going to be like winnowing grain. God is comparing Babylon the Great to the chaff that flies away when the grain is threshed and winnowed. Really a very, very amazing picture that we have there. All right, so God, first of all, is speaking to Babylon, telling them what he's going to do to them. And then God speaks to the Jews, beginning in verse 5 and going down through verse 10. What has he got to say to the Jews? Well, he assures this people that he hasn't absolutely forsaken them. All right, he hasn't widowed them, okay? And so he orders them a second time now. I want you all to get, first he tells them to go to Babylon. Now for a second time he tells them, I want you out of Babylon at the first opportunity. Okay? Notice verse 6. Flee out of the midst of Babylon. He's talking to the remnant that went down there. These are the ones that obeyed him the first time. Flee out of the midst of Babylon and deliver every man his soul. Be not cut off in her iniquity, for this is the time of the Lord's vengeance. He will render unto her a recompense. And you can make sure that when he says he's going to do something, he'll get the job done. So when Cyrus actually opened the door for these people to actually go home, we know historically that approximately 50,000 Jews came back to Judah for the purpose of restoring the city and actually rebuilding the temple. Okay. Now, there was a whole lot more than 50,000 that went, but only 50,000 came back with the first wave from the deportation. Babylon had essentially been, remember, back in 25, chapter 25 is key because it has tentacles to the rest of the whole book in both directions. God says, I'm the wine cup, right? Or I'm going to dispense the wine of my fury and my wrath. Well, Babylon had been the wine cup in God's hands. And they're making the nations act like drunks, which, by the way, it's fascinating, and for the sake of time, we can't do it. But if you compare this section, Jeremiah 50 and 51, with Revelation 18 and the revived Babylon, you have some amazing analogies from both texts that match perfectly, even though they're two completely different entities there. You have a revived Babylon that will emerge later on during the tribulation period. So God's hand, you know, the wine out of the cup of God's hands is making the nations act like drunks. Particularly in Revelation 18 and verse 3, you have that imagery really, I think, borrowed from this very section in the book of Jeremiah. But now that cup's going to be smashed, and Babylon's powers are going to be broken, and God tells the Jews, howl for her. Really an amazing, look at verse 8 of chapter 51. Babylon is suddenly fallen and destroyed. Howl for her. Take balm for her pain. If so be, she may be healed. All right, these people had the sense to obey God the first time, so it just may be possible that they might have a little bit of God's heart and want to see these people saved and actually wind up ministering to them. And God tells these remnant Jews to howl or wail for the plight of these Babylonians. By the way, anybody that pinned their hopes on Babylon was absolutely destined to be doomed to complete disappointment. just like anybody today in the year, as we approach the year 2024. And I'm pinning all of my hopes on the things of this world. Well, I guarantee you one thing, you will be completely disappointed before it's over. That's an absolute promise. The world passeth away, right? But he that doeth the will of God shall live forever. 1 John 2:17. Now, let me ask you a question. In verse 9, chapter 51, who is the we referring to? Right? Don't answer too soon. We would have healed Babylon, but she's not healed. Forsake her and let us go, everyone, into his own country. For her judgment reacheth unto heaven and is lifted up even to the skies. So now this is very important. When you're doing Bible study, if you make a wrong connection of a pronoun and to its antecedent, if you get the antecedent wrong, you've missed the whole message of the book. And this is particularly important when you're doing things like the prophets or in narratives. You come across this, it's not a problem, but it's an issue of hermeneutics. You have to be able to identify who actually the speaker is. And sometimes it's easier said than done. Here is an excellent example of why sometimes it's very difficult to do. So I'll ask you again, who is the we referring to? Is it referring to the Jews? Or is it possibly referring to Babylon's allies? And now they see the jig is up and they've deserted her? All right, well, sometimes you got to examine a bigger portion of the context. And so what I see is that, notice, since the us in verse 10, see there's an our and an us in verse 10, that can only be the Jews, okay, and their vindication. So I think the we in verse 9 is the exiles, okay, the remnant that actually went down the first time, because Jeremiah, as they were going down there, he left them with instructions. He said, I want you to be a blessing while you're living there. I want you, you're still representing Jehovah, and I want you to be a blessing while you're living in Babylon. And we don't have time, but we can go back to chapter 29 where Jeremiah gave those instructions. Don't just go down there and feed your flesh. You go down there and minister. And so, no doubt, you did have a lot of saved people in that crowd. They did seek the Lord. They did confess their sins. They did trust God when he said, I promise I will deliver you someday. They believed in the 70-year extension. Some of them certainly prepared their sons and daughters to go back to Israel someday. They were bringing their kids up just for that purpose. They had truth about Jehovah God, and they would have shared it with their captors. But the Babylonians preferred instead to torture these people. And actually, they had it actually pretty good. But they certainly wouldn't listen. They laughed at the Jews is what they did. They taunted them instead of listening to them. And so you actually get a little bit of a glimpse of what these people went through in Psalm 137. They would have liked to have ministered to their captors. But it says in verse 1 of Psalm 137, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. See, it's all taunting and mocking. Sing us one of those Jew songs. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? And then God says, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. You know, so you can just cut and paste the first five verses at least of the 137th Psalm and stick it just right in there next to verses 9 and 10. Okay, so let's go back to our movements. God speaks to Babylon in chapter 50, verse 31 through 51:4. God speaks to the Jews in verses 5 through 10 of chapter 51. And now thirdly, God speaks back to Babylon again in verses 11 through 23. And he warns them. He says, you who get your weapons ready. Set up your standards. Get your walls in shape. Post your watchmen, because the invasion is about to begin. All right. He basically is going to tell them, your time has come and you're going to be cut off. All right. Notice verse 13. 51:13. O thou that dwellest upon many waters, abundant in treasures. Now notice what's the next words. Thine end is come, along with your covetousness, and the measure of thy covetousness. Very sobering, to say the least. And then he goes on to describe, they'd been weaving this tapestry. They had this world-class loom, and they were making this amazing tapestry, I guess is what you'd call it. And in there, and they'd get, part of the thread would be their power. Their power went into this thing. And then their wealth would go in to make this tapestry as well. But now God's going to cut the whole thing off and just put a total, complete end to all of that. And that's essentially the essence of verses 11, 12, and 13, as you can see. Then he kind of describes for them the enemy soldiers to them, to Babylon. They're going to swoop down on the Babylonians like locusts, all right, proving their utter helplessness and the complete futility of ever trusting in a fake God that they made up of their own imagination. It's almost like a revisitation of the plagues of Egypt again in the book of Exodus. And so Jeremiah is revealing the stupidity of making and worshiping idols. He had done this spectacularly back in chapter 10. And then, you know, then he extols God. After he proves how horrible and stupid the idols are, he shows how great and magnificent God is in chapter 10. So you have a reiteration of that very same thing here in verses 15 through 19. For the sake of time, we're almost out of time already. I can't read all this, but you can kind of glance through it. And you can see that's exactly what's happening. He's magnifying, while belittling their idols, he's magnifying the greatness of the one true and living God. All the prophets did this. Isaiah 40, Isaiah 40 starts a new section in the book of Isaiah. And, you know, they have the whole back half of the 40th chapter of Isaiah is just on the greatness and power and excellence of God. Okay? So God's speaking to Babylon, he's speaking to the Jews, he speaks back to Babylon again, and now he's going to singularly address his general, his Schwarzkopf, if you please, his Ulysses S. Grant, whoever you want to look at it. And that's in verses 20 through 24. Right. Now let me ask you another exegetical question, because it's very important. Who is the they in verse 24? Is that Babylon? I will remember unto Babylon and to all the inhabitants of Chaldea all their evil that they have done in Zion in your sight, saith the Lord. Who is the they? Well, at first glance, it looks like it's Babylon. I would agree with that. It looks like it's Babylon. But just the same way that Assyria had been God's rod, according to Isaiah, to deal with the 10 northern tribes in Isaiah 10, so his chosen commander, and he's actually got two of them, he's telescoping this into Cyrus and then further out into Alexander the Great. In fact, Alexander would be his final hammer. Notice in verse 20, he calls him a battle axe. Thou art my battle axe and weapons of war, for with thee will I break in pieces the nations, and with thee will I destroy kingdoms. And then he continues to tell all the things that Alexander is going to wind up doing, you see, to these people, namely ultimately breaking the power of Babylon. Okay, I think that the pronoun should be you. If it's a reference to Babylon, it should be you, not they. So the they is the conquering soldiers that come in, these two generals in particular, Cyrus and later on Alexander. And then notice in verse 20, you see the word break. Now, there's many different words for break in the Old Testament. This one means to shatter into pieces. Something breaks, you take a pottery, you know, and it smashes into a million pieces. That's what this word is here. And the thing about it is it dominates the section. Okay, it's used 9 times in the passage, this word break. So these people, the first, the Medes and Persians, second, the Greeks under Alexander, they're going to pay Babylon back with the exact same treatment that Nebuchadnezzar had given the Jews and everybody else that he abused. In other words, what goes around comes around. And this is arguably the main lesson of this thing. There is built in to our existence a law of compensation. God built it into his working in history, and he will enforce it. And if it's not enforced in this life, it certainly will be in the next. All right? And then finally, God speaks to Babylon again in verses 25 and 26. You see there? Behold, verse 25, chapter 51, I am against thee. Then he calls them Babylon an interesting thing because they're really not mountainous. There's no mountains in Babylon. They live on a plain. They're kind of water people, actually. Their capital is off the Euphrates. So he calls them anyway. Behold, I'm against thee, O destroying mountain, saith the Lord, which destroyeth all the earth. And I will stretch out my hand upon thee and roll thee down from the rocks, and will make thee a burnt mountain. And they shall not take of thee a stone for a corner, nor a stone for foundations, but thou shalt be desolate forever, saith the Lord. Okay. I'm just intrigued with that burnt mountain picture that God's painting of these people, because they lived on a plain. So God is addressing them the way that the nation saw Babylon. In the sight of the average nation, including Israel, they're this huge, towering Mount Rainier, you know, this destroying mountain that loomed on the horizon of history. But by the time God's through with them, Babylon is going to be nothing. They're just going to be an extinct volcano. And I think that that's the picture of what you see in that phrase, a burnt mountain. Okay, in verse 25 there. In fact, nobody's ever going to even excavate the ruins to find the stones to rebuild it with. The revived Babylon, which I think will be literal, will not be on the exact same site as the original Babylon. It'll bear the same name, Mother of Harlots, but it won't be in the exact same place. Because this place is still to this day, just like Sodom and Gomorrah, deserted and desolate forever. Because that's God's pronunciation on it. All right, then finally, in verses 27 to 58 of chapter 51, you have God's announcement of the great victory over Babylon. Now, all throughout this prophecy, okay, God has very frequently announced the fall of Babylon, all through the whole thing. But this closing final section here, it seems to focus on just God's complete devouring of this enemy. It comes in 3 movements. So let me just tell you what the movements are. In verses 27 through 33, God's describing the victory. Okay, God's got armies too. And his armies are prepared. His commanders are ready. Gabriel undoubtedly leading this crowd. It's a very fascinating angelology, frankly. And the battle has begun. The Babylonians are helpless against God's army. They're described as, in verses 27 through 33, they're laying there on the walls exhausted. You know, they got their hands over their head, the one leg is drooping over the edge, and they're just spent. Courage, that's gone. Courage has completely failed them. The city is in flames, the bars of the gates are completely broken down, and so there's nothing to keep the enemy from entering into the city and doing to it what the Babylonians had done to everybody else, especially Jerusalem. Okay? Now, what you see in these verses, which I'm hoping you're skimming, verses 27 through 33, that did not happen when Cyrus came in and took Babylon. Okay? And it's very important to know that. Because what we know from the actual account in the book of Daniel is that Cyrus's army was already in the city before the Babylonians even knew that they were in there. Right? Belshazzar's partying when he sees the writing on the wall. And so what Cyrus had done was he diverted the waters of the Euphrates. And he entered in underneath the gates. All right, so it was a surprise attack. So that can't be the Cyrus. What you see in verses 27 through 33 is a depiction of Alexander the Great. All of that, you plug in 330 BC. And that's Alexander. Okay. By the way, the Babylonians had a better system than our American Pony Express. They had a courier system. They could very quickly send messages all across the whole Babylonian Empire. A relay system that was, they drilled these guys. It was magnificent. When you're considering how they were able to get information out without telephones, without cell phones, without, you know, without the emails and text messages, you know, just amazing. But Jeremiah is describing these runners meeting the exchanging messages for the king. Okay? In other words, here comes one guy with a message. The river crossings have been seized. Here's another guy with a message. The marshes are on fire. Here's another guy with a message. The soldiers are completely terrified. Here's a guy with a final message. The city has been captured. You see all of that in verses 31 and 32, this series of messages being relayed by this courier system. So this is God's harvest. Babylon is on the threshing floor, cut down like a field of grain and then thrown up into the air for the winnowing and separating of the chaff. So you have this amazing description of the victory that God wins over these people, verses 27 through 33. And then God's going to address the Jews again. In verses 34 through 50. Okay, first, the Jews remind the Lord what Nebuchadnezzar had done to them. In verses 34 and 35, I'm not reading it because we're out of time. Okay, verses 34 and 35, it said, Lord, you know what a monster this guy was. Like an absolute monster. He picked us up, all right, like we were a jar filled with food. He just inhaled the whole jar. Then he spit it all out and then broke the jar. Okay. In fact, it's been scenes like this in Jeremiah that some of our colloquialisms come. Like we chewed him up and spit him out. That it comes from this. Yeah. So the Jews want the Lord repay for us. All right. All the suffering that we went through from these people. And God's reply is pretty encouraging. It's really, he's like a court advocate, all right? I will take your case, okay? I will plead your cause, and I will vindicate you. All that is in verse 36, okay? And the Lord is describing very vividly what's going to happen to Babylon. The ruins of the city are going to become the haunt of every disgusting animal and cagey bird. It'll be a perpetual cemetery for everybody that gets slain in the invasion. It's going to be turned into a slaughterhouse. And people are just going to go, it's going to be like you see cattle and sheep and goats dying in the fields from a plague. Okay, one more thing. We're completely out of time, but let me just point out one. Verse 41, who's Shishak? How is Shishak taken? How is the praise of the whole earth surprised? How has Babylon become an astonishment among the nations? Well, there you have the answer. I mean, it answers its own question. It's not even a question, really. Shishak is another code name for Babylon, just like the Chaldeans. Chaldeans is not a code name, but Shishak is. Now, this is the second time that Jeremiah uses this word Shishak to describe Babylon. He did it in chapter 25. And verse 26. And what they do is they follow a system where you take the last letter of the alphabet is substituted for the first letter of the alphabet. Okay? And then you take the next to the last letter for the second letter of the alphabet, and so on. So you're kind of rearranging the alphabet to come up with new words, and that's what they did here. So using that system of switching these letters around, it actually spells out the original Babylon, Sheshach. It's a code name. Well, Jeremiah is using a code name for the enemy in one sentence, and then in the very next breath he calls them Babylon. I'm not sure. Don't ask me why. I tried to figure it out. I just have not. In other words, God wants all the bases covered. That's the best I can do. Whatever name people know these people by, God's got it covered. Okay, whether it's the Chaldeans, Sheshach, Babylon, he's got it all covered. All right, so the army, the enemy army, is going to cover Babylon like the sea will cover the land in verse 42. And when the tide is out, all right, there'll be a desert left behind. Okay. So this Babylonian monster, yeah, he swallowed up God's people. But the Lord is going to force him. The imagery is astounding. It's almost like something out of like Revelation chapter 5. It reminds me of. This monster devoured the people, including the Jews. And God's now going to, you know, kind of do a Heimlich maneuver on the monster and disgorge these people out of its mouth. That's the picture of verse 44. Okay. And then Cyrus is going to permit them to go home. The wall of Babylon shall fall, verse 44. And that literally came true under Alexander. All right? The wall came down when Cyrus decreed that the exiles could go back to Judah and rebuild their temple. Okay. All right, now, quickly, for the third time, God orders his people to get out of Babylon in verse 45. Get out. Remember, he told them, go in, now I want you out. And make haste, don't linger. It's really the same kind of urgency that God tells Lot to get out of Sodom with. Don't look back, just get out now. It's the same urgency, same tenses of the verbs that you find in Genesis 19. Okay? And don't be afraid of the rumors that you're going to hear about what's about to happen. You know, don't be afraid of these fake Babylonian idols that can do you absolutely nothing. They can't hinder you. They can't stop you. Okay? And then God tells them heaven and earth is going to sing. The angels will sing when they see Babylon fallen. Verse 48. And you got the exact same thing in Revelation 18 with the revived Babylon, the mother of harlots. All right? And then finally, in verses 51 through 58, the Jews speak and God replies. Okay? Now, the exiles, they felt disgraced before the world because of what the Babylonians had done to the temple. They all were aware that the temple was in ruin back in Jerusalem. And if the Lord's not strong enough to protect his own house, how could he ever be strong enough to defeat Babylon? In other words, some of them may have been thinking if they left Babylon, they're going to go home only to ruin and shame. Well, during the years that they were in captivity, those 70 years, those that had obeyed Jeremiah's instructions, back in chapter 29, for example, they probably lived pretty well. They enjoyed very comfortable lives. They were told to plant your fields, plant your crops, buy your houses, live a normal life, and they probably lived pretty good. So they're going to be exchanging, some of them may feel, security in Babylon for danger. And we're going to exchange plenty and comfort now for want, right? And again, it reminds me of the Jews in the earlier days wanting to go, why did we ever leave Egypt? We had leeks, you know? But God made it very clear there's no future in Babylon. He told them he was going to destroy the city in verse 56. See that? If you stay in Babylon, you're going to suffer the same fate that the Babylonians are going to suffer. If you obey me and return home, you're going to experience a new beginning under my blessing. And so it's really a matter, I mean, what's wrong with God, this yo-yo? Go to Babylon, get out of Babylon, go to Babylon, get out of Babylon, get out of Babylon. It's a matter of walking by faith and not by sight. Sometimes you have to do that even when it does not make sense. Really. Sometimes you have to walk by faith and not by sight, even when it makes zero sense to you. And if you do, you'll reap the benefits of obeying God. If you don't, you'll suffer the consequences. It's just that simple. And the worst thing we can do is apply our own human evaluation to a scenario and say, well, that doesn't make any sense. All right.